Off the ball.
The Premier League is back on Off the Ball with two live and exclusive commentaries every Sunday.
Rashford on the edge of the area, gets the shot off and scores!
And the best analysis around from Brian Kerr, Kenny Cunningham, Damien Delaney and John Giles.
Nothing to do with the system. It's getting your best players to play in the best positions.
We've got the football show weeknights from 9, live goals every Saturday from 1 and the biggest games every Sunday.
Off the Ball.
Home of the Premier League.
With Paddy Power.
Live and exclusive every Sunday
on News Talk.
Now then, busy football show this evening. Very happy to say, first off, Miguel Delaney is with us from the London Independent. Miguel, evening.
Evening.
Great to have you with us. So, Gareth Bale, Spurs, it looks like this is going to happen.
Well, I think there's still a significant amount of negotiation to go through, which is kind of inevitable, given the parties involved, Daniel Levy, Bale's agent, Jonathan Barnett, and Madrid, who are all pretty much all renowned as among the hardest negotiators in the business. And on all quite famous for getting deals they want or being very stubborn about it if they don't, which is why I think this could actually rumble on a bit. But the latest I'd heard today was that they were a bit closer to a deal where Spurs would pay 50% of the wages, whereas Madrid wanted Spurs to pay 100% of the wages. But I think Madrid are the club the party here with greater need, given that from what I was told yesterday, Zidane is basically just sick of Bale. Doesn't want to see him around the squad anymore, and that compromises the strength of Madrid's position. Well, obviously, as we know, Bale, if he doesn't get his move, he'd be willing to stay there. And Spurs, they'd love this signing. I've heard Levy in particular is pushing it, but in a weird way, even though he'd obviously make it such a difference to their team, he's not the player they absolutely need. So it's why I can maybe see this being done on the Spurs side and relative to the star he is and the situation, not at too great a cost to Spurs.
So this has moved from outright purchase to loan deal?
Yeah, that's what looks likely at the moment. Madrid would prefer to sell, but given Spurs' situation, I think right now it would be a year loan, which is not what Madrid want. They'd rather, because they know, if Bale plays brilliantly, then they've suddenly got a player with value on their hands. But I think they're worried if they send him on loan, they have the same problem in a year's time.
And Spurs are willing to pay that'd be about $300,000 a week, even if they're only playing half his wages?
I think due to bonus and that, I don't think it'd be quite that big. I'd imagine closer to 250. Because the other side to this as well is that, given the dressing room politics and things like that, I don't think they'd be comfortable with him getting paid more than Harry Kane. Hmm. There is a certain amount of speculation to all these figures, but from what we know, I think Kane's on around $250,000. And I can't see Bale being given more than that by Spurs, certainly. But it's an interesting signing. I mean, I suppose this is what, when you appoint a manager like Mourinho to replace Mauricio Pochettino, that's what it signals. But it is quite remarkable. For a lot of the past few years, and even before Pochettino really, Spurs were a club that kind of had this whole, buy low, sell high approach, which meant they were always buying the next best thing. Levy had a policy of kind of never signing players for more than 30 million, things like that. Whereas now they're kind of basically, it's a bit of a kind of, go on an approach. Like we would just go out and buy. I mean, I was going to say something more vulgar there, but now it's go out and just buy and get in, this kind of age star. And let's not forget, this is something, Joe, something very similar to this happened at Manchester United with Mourinho, where we all thought Alexis Sanchez was a great deal on huge money, and that this would be the attacker to make Mourinho's fairly rudimentary football look that much better. But it didn't really work out there. Now, I don't think Bale is shot in the same way that Alexis Sanchez was. And it's obviously different circumstances, but there are some parallels.
Yeah, that is the really fascinating question. I mean, he's still only 31. His career has petered out like a 37-year-old at Real Madrid, the way things have gone. We don't really know, because there is such little evidence over the past 2 years, certainly from a La Liga point of view and a Champions League point of view at Madrid. We don't know what type of 31-year-old Bale is pitching up here at Spurs.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, there have been questions over his fitness for the past 2 years, but really the main issue is that pretty much from the off in 2015-16, Zidane didn't really take to him. And that has been the undercurrent of Bale's career since. And it's probably meant, I mean, for all the talk about his age, it's probably meant he's played far less than a player of his stature would, which could be to Spurs and his benefit, and that there might be a fair bit more football out of him to come. Some people in Spain say that he has dropped off. the one thing about that, I mean, I think if you've got a fit Bale, he's still capable of, what, 10 to 15 match-winning moments a season? Makes a difference, especially for a club like Spurs, more so even than a club like Real Madrid.
I mean, I wonder, like, Gareth Bale looking at Spurs right now and looking at Jose Mourinho right now, I wonder, is he having second thoughts? I mean, this doesn't seem like the most vibrant environment to pitch yourself back into. I know the comforts of familiarity must be a very pleasant thought to him, given his exile, as it's felt like over the last couple of years. But, geez, it doesn't feel like he'll be rocking up to a happy environment on Monday whenever he does end up going.
Well, there's both an element of romance about this move and an element of kind of many opposites of romance in terms of, because Spurs, right, I this points to what I was saying earlier about the kind of the departure of Mourinho, but they really seem to be, and it ties in with the whole Amazon documentary, they really seem to be going for this kind of, you know, box office content production as opposed to, you know, very steady squad building in that way. And it's, at the moment, it's to go with a documentary, it's big name after big name, and you could even apply the signing of Alex Morgan to that for the women's team, given he was probably the most renowned star in the women's game. Or certainly one of them, and that's see, Spurs at the moment, a lot of what they seem to do seems to be related to getting global attention, and perhaps the Bale signing fits into that. Now, some around the club would think that this potentially fits in to the possibility of trying to get a sale. For the moment, Spurs still totally deny that the club is up for sale, but certainly when you become this globally visible, it would help in that regard.
Do we know much of Bale's mindset? You know, it's been hard to know from afar if he's just been very unlucky and the circumstances at the club have never quite worked out fully for him. And, you know, it's very understandable that someone might withdraw into themselves. And he always seemed like, you know, that character more so than, you know, a push everyone out of my way type. But it's difficult to know from afar. Was there a lack of fight about him, you know, to kind of just grab his career and sort things out before it went, you know, completely off the rails? And there was talk of him going to China last year, which really worried me. You know, when you're trying to deduce someone's mindset and their level of ambition, that China was going to be his escape route. It's really hard to know, is Bale just somebody who is understandably, you know, cowed by the circumstances, or is this a guy who actually is, you know, looks at all his Champions League medals and is kind of happy enough and at 31 is kind of done? Do we have any strong sense of that, Miguel?
Well, I was talking to someone who interviewed Bale recently, and they were saying while he was very measured in most of his answers and all this, when it came to Spurs, he actually got a little bit excited and spoke about it with enthusiasm that maybe you would no longer associate with Bale's career. Yeah. Now, I know that sounds maybe a bit naive and innocent, but maybe I think it does maybe reflect what you're saying, that, I mean, for all the criticisms of Bale lately, I think some of that has been circumstantial, that he's just been at a club where he knows this is just about almost getting through the contract. And there was an element of kind of golden handcuffs about it as well, in that because he was so well paid on such a long-term deal, it made it very difficult to do anything. And it was a point of principle as well. Yeah, I think it could work out for Spurs in that regard.
Interesting times. And what about Spurs then at the weekend? You know, I didn't get to see this game, but I saw the highlights, and Matt Doherty, to my eye, looked to be involved in a few of their better moments, not least the goal chance, where, you know, they were listless for so much of that game, and he injected a bit of pace into proceedings. And, you know, if he'd scored that goal, it puts a real sheen on things. But then Mourinho's comments afterwards caught the eye, where he made a point of, instead of focusing on the positive aspects of Doherty publicly, at least, he pointed out that this guy was nowhere near, you know, fit enough. Excuse making, really. And probably, you know, if you're Doherty, geez, you're thinking, this is not necessarily the start I want with the Spurs fans. They're going to pay attention to what you're saying after a game, Mourinho. And I thought, you know, stage one of destroying Matt Doherty, complete.
Well, this is it. Welcome to Jose Mourinho. I mean, I'd say the comments were curious, but what do we expect at this point? I mean, almost everything Mourinho says now in the media is basically about his own image management. And Doherty, he is going to have to adjust to a new position there. In general, though, I thought it was a poor display from Spurs. And funnily enough, I was talking to someone connected to the Everton team yesterday morning, and they were very unimpressed with what Spurs were trying to do, and made the point that fitness isn't really an excuse at this point, because everyone's in the same situation. And Everton is probably as close to Spurs in that situation as any club could be. So, you know, it doesn't really bear out here.
And what were Spurs trying to do? Like, Doherty, for instance, was playing incredibly high up the pitch for starters.
So someone said to me, basically, that he was just long balls. That was all. They seemed devoid of ideas. And watching from TV, I wasn't at the game on Sunday. It's hard to disagree with that. And that's been pretty much a trend of his time at Spurs and also the last few years of his management, where there just seems a very laissez-faire approach to attack. It's sometimes, I mean, when he was at Chelsea in 15-16, when this all started to break down, first of all, someone close to Hazard was telling me that while he gives some broad definitions, Mourinho, his attacking idea is kind of based on leaving the players to figure it out themselves. And in the modern, and that's fine when players are on form and feel on it. But in the modern game, as we've spoken about a lot here, most the kind of the best practice, or really not even the standard practice at the top sides now, with all the top managers, is to have an idea of play that they can all fall back on. That almost creates these kind of automatisms, as they call them. So if they're not on top form, they at least have a blueprint. Whereas Spurs don't seem to have that blueprint. And when it's not really working for them, they just resort to this, which is knocking it along and not doing much. And I suppose one of the differences with Mourinho's approach is, which is relevant to Doherty, is that of that back four, it's really kind of three centre-halves and a right wing-back, which he has played before. But it does put a lot of onus on Doherty. And it could be a little bit of a testing time for him.
Yeah, and that approach to attacking play on Mourinho's part, that is that was born out at Manchester United. They became utterly listless and there was no sense of pattern about their play. There was never a pattern when you watched Manchester United under Mourinho in terms of attacking play. And you think to Matt Doherty's phone radio interview on 2FM after Martin O'Neill departed, and Doherty said, well, you know, Nuno tells me exactly what to do. I know exactly what I'm meant to do. I'm a cog in a well-functioning team. And I never got that kind of feedback at Ireland. I mean, he may very, very well be raising an eyebrow right now when he's here working under Jose. You know, for much of Doherty's career, Jose would have been the very top of the game and thinking, what is this? You know, the guy back at Wolves was shown, you know, a much better framework here. So that's going to be very interesting. What of Jose this season then? I mean, Bale arriving will probably be a fill-up for everybody, for sure. But it's hard to know if this thing's going to career off track very, very quickly this season.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll suit Mourinho to a certain degree because, as what we've been talking about, his attacking play is now almost based on individual moments of brilliance.
Yeah.
And Bale is one player. In fact, Bale is probably better at doing that than Harry Kane, who requires service. And it does feel like Kane has maybe suffered a little bit in terms of goal scoring under Mourinho. I think that could be a kind of a temporary bam that basically make Spurs work for a time before the kind of deeper problems manifest themselves, as we saw at United. I mean, let's not forget, for as bad as it went at United, he did finish second in that second season, which is pretty good given how far City were ahead and given their points all. But again, that was based on amazing individual performances. In that case, and most of all, David De Gea. I think we might see similar here for a time, but as we've seen before, Mourinho could paper over the cracks because what they do is ultimately behind the rest of the top clubs.
Opening weekend then, we have Chelsea-Liverpool this weekend coming, which will be interesting. What did you make of Liverpool? There's been plenty of talk of Leeds for obvious reasons, but what about Liverpool's performance at Anfield?
Not that surprising, actually, because I think they started a little bit slowly last season as well. And it was as if it took them a while to get up to speed. There was also some defensive errors last season as well. We saw that in a very similar game at the start of last season against Norwich, but Norwich weren't as good as Leeds, so couldn't punish Liverpool. Leeds did here and then got a little bit unlucky, a little bit kind of self-inflicted destruction, and also a large part Liverpool being as good as they are. I've been kind of wavering all summer on this in terms of those predictions we have to make, in that I can't fully decide if it's going to be City or Liverpool. And weirdly, after that win, and just getting a first win, what was an awkward enough opening fixture, even if they weren't brilliant, I'd almost lean towards Liverpool again, because I think they obviously, you can see the kind of cohesion of the team is there, the idea is there, the players are still just about the right age, and I think they will become much better than this.
Jurgen Klopp was asked about this game for obvious reasons. It's on this Sunday, and he was saying Liverpool have a different approach to clubs owned by countries and oligarchs. which was quite the line. Frank Lampard said he was more amused than angry when he saw the line. Klopp and Pep Guardiola, very, you know, under the circumstances over the last couple of years, very respectful, cordial relationship. This Lampard-Klopp thing seems like a genuine-ish beef, in so much as we all like to hype these things up, admittedly. What are you hearing about this?
I think there's some genuine tension there. I mean, Lampard's quite a prickly character. And we saw it even with an issue as serious as kind of when Raheem Sterling broached, you know, institutional racism. Where, you know, he was arguing about how white former players are just inevitably given better chances than black players. And Lampard took issue with this, basically, and talked how hard he's worked. When that's one of those situations where it's a bit like not all men. He shouldn't be fixating on, like, it's not about him, even though he was name-checked. It's about a wider issue. But I think it points to a prickliness about Lampard that has been seen repeatedly with Klopp, and I think there's a genuine tension there. Again, as you say, to hype these things up, I do think this is very real, and it's something that could bubble over maybe this weekend and over the course of the season, especially if they're in a title race. And to be fair, Klopp as well, while he is the nicest, most lovable guy in the world when things are going well, he's a very bad loser as well. I've seen him in some, when we've had those little huddles in post-game press conference where like a few kind of journalists for the daily papers will stand around him, and he's not had a good result. And someone asked what is kind of like, all right, not an easy question, but not exactly a hard one. He'll lash out sometimes. We're not lash out, but he'll get spiky about it in a way that you think that doesn't necessarily warrant it. So there are the ingredients there for maybe a properly modern managerial rivalry. Maybe something to go to rival Mourinho and Guardiola back in the day. As regards the Abramovich thing, I should actually plug this. My employers will be happy because I'm doing a big piece this week on the kind of new Roman Empire, if you want to call it this, because this is, I think it's a really interesting subject, and it's kind of almost the story of the summer. The fact that at a time like this, you know, with so many COVID restrictions, Abramovich and Chelsea have chosen now to embark on actually what is, in absolute terms, their most lavish ever summer. They've even surpassed the spending of 2003. Now, obviously, inflation's a factor in that. But I think it's very interesting, particularly given some of the questions over the last few years about Abramovich's long-term interest in Chelsea, whether he wants to sell up. And this would be a very firm riposte to that. But it could have consequences for Lampard in that, you know, while I was told that last season's autumn form really enlivened Abramovich and got him kind of fired up about football again, especially because he's always been invested in the Chelsea academy and wanted players to get through, and he could see players that he used to do research on the academy and kind of always try and put, you know, names to faces and styles of play, and it actually kind of apparently it did warm him to see all these players that he knew finally coming through. But then it's interesting that one of the responses to that has been to buy a load of players that could replace them.
And it
does point to one of the more interesting questions towards the entire Chelsea project. I mean, you could even argue that for all the success they've had, Abramovich has so far failed in what he wants more than anything, which is basically a team with loads of players coming through, playing to an identity that is immediately gets you up off your feet. I mean, and what he's describing is basically Barcelona 2011. And he's never had that. And one of the reasons he's never had that is probably because he personally hasn't necessarily shown the patience required to cultivate it. And it's why that expenditure is all the more interesting this summer, because now, from a situation where last year Lampard had a free hit, judging by everything Chelsea have had before, there's suddenly real pressure for Lampard to produce now.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I hadn't realised that he was a romantic soul and invested in the academy. And, you know, allegedly that Brazilian Ronaldo hat-trick against United was one of those nights where he was in attendance and it seemed to spark a real sense that I want to get involved in this, you know. So, to go out and spend 200 million, and as you said, probably bump a fair few of those academy graduates off the team, is an interesting move. To what extent then does 200 million spent over the summer bridge the gap of 33 points?
I think I actually go quite a distance. Not as much for the type of season this is than what Chelsea are and how good they are, because this is going to be, I mean, I was doing the calculations when the fixture list came out, and as far as I can see, there's never been a season as intense like that. If you're a top player, you feasibly have a fixture every 3 days, which is unprecedented. There's never been a fixture this packed or crunched into so much time. And for that reason alone, squad depth has never been so important. And Chelsea, by far, have a squad depth much greater than anyone else in the league. And I think that will make up a lot of points. Especially if you look at a situation, I mean, there's been some controversy, even what we're talking about there, say where Havertz might potentially take Mason Mount's place. Where, I mean, if you can interchange between the two of them in any given game, I mean, it gives you an advantage over a lot of your rivals. I mean, not even Manchester City, for all their lavish expenditure, have quite the same options as that. Mm. So I think that's going to go a long way. My reservation, when it comes right down to it, I'd have the same almost wonder about Lampard as I do about Solskjaer, and that we still don't really know how good a manager he is. And if, say, they had someone like, I know we've mentioned him so many times in this programme, but if you had someone like Pochettino in charge of that squad, it'd be much more of a certainty.
Where is Pochettino this weather? He's got to pop up somewhere this season.
Waiting. I was thinking about this recently. For all that I would have defended his approach to the League Cup and FA Cup when he was at Spurs, and I think it made sense for him to try, when you're a club like that who are stretched to a certain degree, and he wants to kind of make progress in the big trophies, which is the league and the Champions League, given that means so much more. But I wonder, as regards his own future, whether the fact he didn't win a trophy actually counts against him. Because when you're a club like Juventus, like Madrid, like Barcelona, who he's flirted with a lot over the past few years, and like, I mean, with Barcelona recently, the amount of interviews he seemed to give where he was announcing that he was withdrawing his comments that he'd never managed them because he used to be with Espanyol. He must have done that about 3 or 4 times. You know, they still went elsewhere. I do wonder, though, whether when you're a club like that, to appoint a manager who's won nothing, even if that's a very simplistic perspective, whether that worked against him. And it's hard not to think it did. It would just, even if you had that one trophy, it would alter a lot. And you could sell the appointment much easier. But while that CV is blank in that regard, I think it has worked against him. In saying that, if things go wrong with Solskjaer, I do think United will be straight back in there. And like, there's a few people that say they reckon he's still waiting for United above anyone else. But we'll see. And again, the fact that this is such an intense season, where I think it's going to cause much more of an inconsistency among the top six than it has in the last few years, could bring a fair few junctures and changes.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating season ahead. There's been it's very difficult to predict where the chips are going to fall. So, for instance, Arsenal, that stock is rising, Miguel. If you want to buy Arsenal, you need to buy fast. Aubameyang has signed his contract. I belong here, he said. So he's the club's top earner now. Willian settled in seamlessly, as you kind of would have expected, a player of his history and quality. Elneny seems to be increasingly comfortable in midfield. They've signed Gabriel, which gives everybody a hope, a new signing, centre defence. And Arteta seems to have got to grips with things. They did only play Fulham. So, I mean, if there's ever a time not to get ahead of ourselves, this would be it. But there is a sense that they're moving in the right direction. To what extent is the question?
Yeah, I think that's it. Even though it was Fulham, you can see there's a clear idea there. I was at the Cup final, very, very impressed, and as well as at the Cup semi-final, very impressed where they looked there in big games. And in some ways, the Fulham win was important because consistency of result was about. And I mean, there had been some suspicion at the end of last season, or some questions of whether Arsenal would be good in these big games, but they dropped too many points elsewhere in that kind of classic way. But there's almost a kind of a rock, paper, scissors element to the top six at the moment. And I say, with Chelsea, they've got the squad and the resort and a certain amount of momentum, but there are questions over the manager. With City, they've got the manager, they've got the squad and the resources, but there's that question whether they lack the momentum, whether you know it's fifth season for Guardiola, a situation never been in, whether it could be a bit tired. Whereas Arsenal, they've got the manager who looks very good. They've got momentum because there's a real feel-good vibe around the club now, around the first team. But they don't necessarily have the squad resources, and that you still just feel it's maybe a little bit short on quality, and they're going to be trying to make do for a little while, certainly in contrast to the strength that Chelsea have or strength that City or Liverpool have.
What about the two Manchester clubs then, briefly, before we let you go? So Man City play Wolves on Monday. I mean, we could have had Messi. We could have Messi lining up against Wolves, Miguel, but not quite to be. So are they? Do we think they were legitimately hopeful of having Messi in the lineup, and they're therefore kind of reeling a little bit and picking up the pieces? or where are they? Because it's not like they've made major signings.
I think for a week, there was a genuine sense they could get him. But even that was tempered by the reality that even if they had been given the all clear and he was going to leave Barca, it possibly wouldn't have played against Wolves this weekend because Messi would have been embroiled in a court case with Barcelona. Mm. but in saying that, certainly maybe for the fans of those outside, the prospect of Messi now makes everything seem that feel a little bit lesser. But in saying that, I think the signings they have made are what they needed. I think they still need a first-choice centre-half. I mean, I think Ake's been brought in there as backup, but Torres is a very good signing in that he's almost a direct replacement for Sané, and he's a really high-quality young Spanish player. He's exactly the sort of profile they need, because that squad is actually almost, in terms of average age, for key players, he's almost pushing the wrong side of their prime. So they are in a better place. But almost the bigger question is about Guardiola, because he's never been in this situation. We've never seen him in a fifth season. And that ties in with, you know, bigger questions over, because you can see it on the touchline, you can see it in his interviews. This is a very intense guy. And no matter how good you are as a manager, when you're that intense, it will start to have an effect on players. It's what we've seen with Mourinho when he was even at his peak. It's what we saw, arguably, and some of the players have talked about this, in his fourth season at Barcelona. So this is one of those bigger questions over City. And it's one of the reasons maybe you'd have some doubts over whether they can reclaim the title.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting as well. And then on the Solskjaer point, I mean, this is probably the defining season, isn't it? I mean, at the end of this year, you'll have a real sense of whether this guy's the real deal or not.
Yeah, completely. And like with a lot of United summer, I mean, it's hard to know which way it'll go. Like from what you hear about Solskjaer, I mean, it's not like he's a complete clown or anything like this. The players all like him and really look up to him. And he very, very obviously has a very positive effect on the squad in a way that hasn't really been seen at United since Ferguson left in 2013. And that really shouldn't be taken for granted. Mm. There is something there with the players. There's a real connection. So he's evidently good in man management. I suppose the bigger question revolves around it's a little bit, funnily enough, given who he replaced, It's a little bit in line with some of the questions about Mourinho and that you question him tactically. You know, someone actually put it to me yesterday that, you know, the agent of one of the players, that Solskjaer actually operates almost this Scandinavian model of management where it puts a lot of trust in these top professionals, but it's a trust that's maybe a little bit out of sync with the modern game. And just as we've been talking about, it's a bit old-fashioned. It expects them to figure out too much of themselves on the pitch, whereas a modern game is all about, you know, sophisticated tactical blueprints and only improvisation when you need it.
Mm. Last one, then. You mentioned you were talking to someone from Everton. So I think it was kind of interesting. You know, just under the radar a little bit, they signed James. And you don't fully engage with that point, maybe because there's not much of an off-season until you're watching them against Spurs and you realise, oh yeah, like James now plays for Everton. And Coleman played very well. I mean, he could have easily been looking over his shoulder a little bit given his age profile and just, you know, change for the sake of it. So they must be feeling pretty good about life all of a sudden.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, as you say, because of his last few seasons, it's easy to overlook. I mean, not completely unlike Bale, and actually in that sense, given they're both Real Madrid players or were, you forget how good he was. I mean, one of the kind of most lightly satisfying moments of my journalism career is basically for that volley against Uruguay. I looked up from my laptop just the moment he was hitting it, so I got to see it. And like, you were there for that World Cup as well, Joe. And I mean, it's easy to forget how much he took hold of that tournament in a way that itself felt quite old fashioned. You don't really see with international tournaments anymore where one player dominates. And I think one of the problems with James is that he probably made exactly the wrong move at that point of his career, where he went to where, for a whole load of reasons, not necessarily related to football, he went to a club where he didn't have an obvious place for him in the team. And it has caused a little bit of a situation where he hasn't maybe fulfilled his talent in the way he should. And now with the game moving on a bit, with kind of some of the issues he's had, it's never felt he's found the right fit. But Everton could be that, in that they're maybe just the right level where they'll build a team around this excellent playmaker and it could be a fit for them. I mean, I would generally question, a little bit like with Spurs, I think there's a danger when you're a club trying to catch up on wealthier rivals to be signing cast-offs from the top clubs. I think it's much more astute to be signing up and coming players and getting ahead of the game in that regard. But in saying that, the right signing can work, and James could well be it. And it's hard not to get excited watching him because he's a brilliant player.
Yeah, no, it's a great addition. So this Premier League season, in spite of obviously the many restrictions around it, is shaping up very nicely. Not for Macclesfield. I keep saying the last question to you. This is the last question. But the Macclesfield story, you know, not that long after Barry, there is a sense we're headed for more of this. Debts exceeding, what, a Gareth Bale weekly wage, and that's them done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, it's actually a year ago, I remember, because we were having this exact discussion about the potential death of the 72 in that regard when the news came up with Barry. There are specific issues to Macclesfield. Okay. There are specific issues to COVID. But this is really all about a wider problem in English football. And it's not a coincidence that a lot of these clubs are struggling. They're from like what would traditionally been a hotbed of football in the Northwest, where ultimately these clubs, they don't quite have the fan base to cover the cost of being legal. I mean, that's quite a broad statement. It doesn't... doesn't specifically apply to all of them. There are individual problems, but this is an issue that so many clubs are facing now. That in a world where the very top of the game demands or consumes so much attention, so much money, there almost isn't enough to go around. That's both attention and cash, and it creates this cycle. Where I mean, the more interest, to say the top six or in Manchester, the two big clubs, City and United, the more interest they get, the more money they get. And then the more interest they get as a response to that. And it's kind of, from talking to people that have worked at lower league clubs, what they repeatedly say is that the eternal challenge is getting bums on seats, because the old culture, the old dad lad, I mean, we're being misogynistic about it, but the old kind of generational culture of passing down your season ticket, it doesn't exist in the same way. And obviously that's something that COVID has made more pronounced. But it's got to be an issue for more and more clubs. It's going to spread beyond the English Northwest.
Okay. Miguel Delaney from the London Independent, brilliant stuff. When's the Abramovich Chelsea piece out? Did you say Saturday?
It's probably going to be Friday morning by the latest, I'd say. We're hoping tomorrow. A few little things to sort out.
There's a man with phone calls from the editor saying, where's that bloody piece? Miguel Delaney, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Cheers.
Off the Ball.
The Premier League is back on Off the Ball with two live and exclusive commentaries every Sunday.
Rashford on the edge of the area, gets the shot off and scores!
And the best analysis around from Brian Kerr, Kenny Cunningham, Damian Delaney and John Giles.
Nothing to do with the system. It's getting your best players to play in the best positions.
We've got the football show weeknights from 9, live goals every Saturday from 1 and the biggest games every Sunday.
Off the Ball.
Home of the Premier League.
With Paddy Power.
Live and exclusive every Sunday
on News Talk.
Now, you're welcome back. So we spoke to Vera Pau a couple of weeks ago, and Ireland take on Germany this Saturday in their Euro qualifiers. Ireland currently sitting top of Group I, but they have played one game extra than the Germans, who, as well as being ranked second in the world right now, have scored 31 goals in this campaign, and they have not conceded a single goal. So scored 31, conceded none. They're very good, is the point, and Vera Pau admitted as much when we spoke to her a few weeks back. That said, Ireland are going to have a go. Dianne Caldwell was in front of the media yesterday, and she actually plays her football in Germany for SC Sand in the Bundesliga. She was asked about German perceptions of this Irish team.
I've just been really listening to a few interviews from their head coach, Martina Voss Tecklenburg, and I think, yeah, she's been respectful of us. She knows that we're a strong team, and that will be a tough test for them at the weekend. But other than that, I haven't heard so much. Of course, my teammates and my friends are all supporting me. They know that the Irish need the support more than Germany right now. So they've all changed allegiances for this weekend. So it's nice to have their support.
You just mentioned the challenge of facing Germany. How do you prepare for that mentally? When you know that if you look at the results, they tend to make quick starts in games, that they're going to be coming at you from first whistle.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of used to playing sometimes like these sort of games. Also at club level, when you play the top teams like Wolfsburg and Bayern Munich, who are full of German internationals. So you know the pace of the game from the onset is going to be so high. And it's just about really having a very specific game plan, know what your roles are, what the key parts of the game are to play through, and just being very well organized, really, and concentration is a big one. You know, against the top teams, they pray for those moments where you perhaps switch off or make a mistake. So those are really the key defining moments that you need to pay attention to and be prepared for.
And because you're one of the leaders of this team, you're obviously based in Germany. You have an insight into how these players play. Have you been going around the hotel almost with a dossier on each player for your teammates?
Yeah, I think I need to. No matter who we play, there's always normally kind of someone that you know on the other side of the team. So I'm always kind of going around and being like given a little pieces of information, like what's her weaker foot or what's her strengths. So yeah, no, I need to definitely go around and relay that information and snippets of information to the girls. But I think most of the girls will know the qualities. We have our huddle network with all of our video analysis, so everyone will have access to their last few games. So everyone is quite good and studious with that. So they check up and see where the key strengths are for the opposition. So they'll know probably from themselves just by personally knowing the players and watching them. You know, a lot of them played in the recent Champions League final. So the highest level of club football. A lot of the girls were playing for Wolfsburg and that. So I think most of the girls will also know of the players individually as well.
And just finally for me, the Dutch game 3 years ago, draw, you played that day. Is it something that's going to be talked about much in the build-up to this game at the weekend?
No, not really. You know, that was a long time ago. It was a different team. Holland, of course, they were European champions at the time and were surprised by us. But, I mean, Germany, no disrespect to the Netherlands, but Germany are a completely different kettle of fish. You know, they've been a dominant force in women's football for over a decade. Numerous World Cups, numerous European championships. So, yeah, it's going to be a massive challenge for us.
You're not going to say Saturday is a free shot, but there's a perception that it's kind of like a free shot for you. I mean, I suppose the question would be, is Saturday more about maintaining the gap between you guys and the rest of the group, or with an eye on qualification, which is your ultimate goal, trying to kind of continue to close the standard, close the gap between you and the elite level of European football? Because there's quite large gaps, I think it's fair to say, in the women's international game, European game as well. I mean, where do you play Saturday's game in that context?
Yeah, there's massive gaps, especially in international football. You know, you can't really compare us to likes of Germany. You know, we're 32nd in the world. They're second, arguably the best team in the world right now with their rebuilding and their new players that they've introduced. So, I mean, obviously our aim is to qualify, but it's a game where we will just give it our best, like we always do. We'll give it our best shot, but realistically, we'll probably have to go through perhaps a playoff, or else, you know, we still have really tough games against Ukraine to come away, and we know how tough that was at home in Ireland, so we're not under any illusions that this is going to be easy. Yes, we're top of the table, but Germany have a game in hand, and we've already messed up away in Greece. We lost points there when we shouldn't have, so we have a long way to go, and still really important games to play.
You mentioned earlier that this German team is a different kettle of fish to the Dutch side you met in Nijmegen.
Yeah.
How different are you guys from that game 3 years ago?
Yeah, it's a good question. Obviously, yeah, Colin was relatively new then. And again, he had started to introduce a few new players into the team then. And that was quite early in our kind of rebuilding phase as well, under him and under his style of play. I think we've progressed since then. We tried to add certain dimensions to our game that Vera has introduced. Again, also different players coming in under different managers. But I think we've definitely taken a step up from that particular squad and that game. But yeah, that result in that game gave the team a lot of confidence and kind of self-belief to go to the weaker teams and kind of impose our game on them, whereas before we always struggled against even the weaker teams per se in the group. So that gave us a bit of a lift and confidence to play the weaker teams. But again, there's still a big gap between us and the likes of Germany.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, Megan was talking about this yesterday, and you mentioned it as well. The need to be asking offensive questions as opposed to defensive questions as well. And when you look back to that World Cup group, you guys were very competitive in the four games against Norway and the Netherlands, but you didn't score. So how has that changed, and how important is that, even from a defensive point of view, to be relieving the pressure on yourselves and asking questions at the far end of the pitch on Saturday?
Yeah, it's massive. You know, you can't just defend for 90 minutes. You just physically and mentally, it's too draining. So you need those out balls. You need to have it pre-planned. Where are we going to try to hit them? In what moments are we going to try to counter? You need it. And that's where we struggled when you look back into that last campaign, that we didn't capitalize. We had chances against the Netherlands, against Norway, but we didn't take them. And I still think that's a work in progress, to be honest. I think obviously our strength is defensively, but we need to work on our offensive attacking abilities now, and to take the chances when they come, and to be a bit more creative and clinical in those transitional moments.
That's Diane Caldwell. She was in front of the media this week. Really, the key game for Ireland in this group will be the Ukraine away on the 23rd of October. Ireland beat the Ukraine 3-2 at home, and that was a very important win. So they'll play Ukraine 23rd of October. To give you a sense of the gap again with Germany, which is very much the focus of this week, Ireland beat the Ukraine 3-2. Germany have played Ukraine twice, and they've beaten them 8-0 home and away in this group so far. So we really are talking about an utterly dominant German side, second in the world, as Diane Caldwell said, they're probably the best team in the world at the moment. 31 goals for, 0 against in this campaign thus far. So this week, I mean, a win would be one of the great results in Irish football in history, probably very unlikely. We'll hear from Heather Payne. She's 20 years of age, one of the younger members of the squad. And Heather is playing her football in Florida. So she was asked, again, similar theme to Diane Caldwell, who we've just heard. She was asked about her mindset going into a game where the gap is so big and you're against a team as dominant as Germany.
So, of course, yeah, Germany are a very good side. We know that they've beaten the rest of the group by a lot of goals. But I think if we do have a game plan and we stick to the game plan, and we're a good quality side, we've great players. We know we're going to work hard. We've always worked hard, and like, we've gotten a result against the Netherlands before, so I don't see how we can't do that against Germany as well. I don't think we're going to get too far ahead of ourselves. I don't think we're going to hopefully not like just drop our heads. We'll just have to stick to the game plan and, you know, do our best and see if we can get a result in the end.
Obviously, the game comes around on Saturday, you've got a week to build up to it, but given just the way the pandemic has been and we've all had a lot of time to ourselves, have you done much tactical work on Germany? Would you be in contact with your teammates and the management team, maybe looking ahead to a game which obviously you would have known weeks in advance it was coming up?
Yeah, so of course with the pandemic it's been difficult since March. Everyone's been stuck at home doing their own thing, and yeah, of course, coming up to this game, we weren't even sure if it was going to definitely go ahead. You know, things are constantly changing in the world, so we have been doing background work for the past month or so, looking ahead, looking at different games. So we've done a bit of work, but of course we have this whole week to prepare for this game, so that's the most important thing. We're going to prepare as a group and go through video analysis, do all that, so we're ready for the game on Saturday.
There you are. That is Heather Payne, 20 years of age, playing football in Florida, and she'll be part of the team heading to Germany this Saturday. It is 1 o'clock kickoff Irish time, and we wish them the best of luck. I'm sure we'll check in with the team maybe next week.
Off the ball.
The Premier League is back on Off the Ball with two live and exclusive commentaries every Sunday.
Rashford on the edge of the area, gets the shot off and scores!
And the best analysis around from Brian Kerr, Kenny Cunningham, Damien Delaney and John Giles.
Nothing to do with the system. It's getting your best players to play in the best positions.
We've got the football show weeknights from 9, live goals every Saturday from 1 and the biggest games every Sunday.
Off the Ball.
Home of the Premier League.
With Paddy Power.
Live and exclusive every Sunday
on News Talk.